Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A major ruling in one state for worker safety. The Great Resignation. Now we have a number and what workers in America are saying. Today on the show, it's We Told You So, The Working Class Was Right, and from the United Steelworkers, the International Affairs Director. Welcome to the Friday, April 22nd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on a number of platforms and growing. Just to name a few, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today, this being the fourth Friday of the month. This is our segment, which we've started well over a decade ago, called Working Class Perspectives. And joining us today is Professor Christopher Martin. He is a professor of digital journalism at the University of Northern Iowa. He's also author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, that came out some years ago. We're going to talk about his blog on working class perspectives titled We Told You So on Trade, The Working Class Was Right. And what we're going to do is go back over 20 years, 1999. The World Trade Organization held its ministerial conference. This was their third one in Seattle. And you may remember that being referred to as the Battle in Seattle. There were about 50,000 protesters from all around the world that descended upon that conference saying, you don't want free trade. No, no. We've seen examples of it throughout the 90s. Not a good idea. Well, obviously, because of all the protesters, they've had numerous conferences after that, but not in this country. That was the last one. They had them in Singapore, Cancun, Geneva, places where protesters really couldn't gather. Bottom line, you fast forward to today, and what happened? Jobs lost. According to the Economic Policy Institute, and we've talked about this on the show a number of times, just with China alone, because what, 2 years after that, 2001, we normalized relations with China, which cost the United States 3.4 million jobs from 2001 to 2017. 3.4 million. And wages went down. Trade with low-wage countries like China, responsible for reducing wages by nearly $2,000 per worker per year. And this is for all of the 100 million non-college educated workers in the United States. Where did that money go? Corporations, my friend. Yep, corporations. We're going to talk about all of this with Dr. Martin. Because once again, the workers know what's going on. In fact, we had this conversation on Monday when we were talking with Jim Slevin, who is the current president of the Utility Workers Union of America. Remember how deregulation with the utilities was going to be beneficial? I don't think so. Nope, 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 nope. Once again, the workers are right. Benjamin Davis will be joining us later in the show, and I'm really, really excited to link up with him. Benjamin is the director of international affairs for the steelworkers, largest industrial union in North America, 850,000 workers in metals, rubber, chemicals, paper, oil, atomic energy, forestry, I tell you. And they're also a sponsor of the show. We appreciate everything they bring to the table. He chairs the Independent Mexico Labor Board, which was established by the Congress to monitor the implementation of the labor provisions of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, often referred to as NAFTA 2.0. Now, this is something, just want to be clear here, Trump negotiated this when he was in the White House, and he said he was going to throw out NAFTA, which essentially he did. However, what he came up with, which was the USMCA, did not have all the labor protections. That was put in place with negotiations with the AFL-CIO, with labor-friendly members of Congress. They pushed those labor provisions, and we have seen the results because they have independent unions now in Mexico. A little more background on Ben. He practiced labor and employment law in Washington for a number of years. He worked as an organizer, a business agent, a researcher, and he also worked with several other unions, including the Service Employees International, hotel employees and restaurant employees, and the American Federation of Government Employees. He also holds a law degree from the American University. Good guy to have on the show, and we're going to talk about what has happened here with trade. Yeah, this is pretty much a trade show. Not to be trite about that, but we're going to talk about what trade has evolved, how trade has evolved, especially how it has affected American workers from many years ago, going back to the late 90s. All right. Major ruling this week on worker safety, and this is from out in Arizona. Arizona has been so deficient in promoting and enforcing worker safety rules that the federal government just might revoke the state's authority to do so altogether. This is pretty significant. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration announced this week that since at least 2014, Arizona has failed to, quote, timely adopt and enforce standards and require directives, at least at comprehensive as or better than federal regulations. Arizona's own agency, the Arizona Division of Occupational Safety, would forfeit their supervisory authority, and OSHA would pretty much take over. They would assume inspections of private employers there. Now, OSHA points to four deficiencies in that state's current program. They failed workers to have enough fall protection at certain height, failed to increase fines on safety violations, which on average has made Arizona's fines only half as large as federal ones, failed to adopt the federal OSHA COVID-19 emergency temporary standard for its healthcare industry, and lastly, they failed to adopt federal minimums on protections against amputations, certain construction accidents, and breathable silica dust. State is just way behind, way behind. In a statement, Doug Parker, who is the Assistant Secretary of Labor, said, "We believe that waiting until OSHA issues another standard would simply provide Arizona with another opportunity to fail to protect workers in a timely manner. If OSHA presses forward on this plan and does not reach a settlement with the state, Arizona would be the first state to involuntarily lose federal approval of its own state-level worker safety plan." So they're giving them some time. What I'm reading, it's the deadline is May 26th. And there's going to be public input. And if, again, they don't come up with anything that makes any sense, the federal government's going to take over. And that's going to be big news. We got a comment here from various people. Shannon Foley, for one. Shannon is the co-chair of the Workers' Safety Committee at IATSE, Local 415. She's also a volunteer with the Arizona Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health. Shannon said, "I don't enjoy saying this, but it's a fact. We need the feds to step in. The Arizona Industrial Commission is too cozy with industry, and they're not doing enough to keep workers safe on the job." She points out at least 100 workers in Arizona died on the job in 2020 from causes that include electrocution and chemical poisoning. Fatal COVID-19 infections in the last 2 years resulted in thousands of worker deaths, largely uninvestigated by the Arizona Division of Occupational Safety and Health. She concluded by saying, this is not about Washington, D.C. versus Arizona or labor versus management. It's all about us pulling together so every worker comes home safely at the end of every shift. We all have a right to a safe workplace no matter what state we live in. How do you argue with that, right? Peter Dooley also spoke out. He's been on our show a couple times. He's a certified industrial hygienist. And he's based in Tucson. Peter said, revoking state authority to enforce workplace safety is not a step to be taken lightly. And he said federal OSHA has tried repeatedly to work with authorities in Arizona to bring the state in compliance, but the state has failed time and time again to fully protect workers. Amazing story, huh? Let's talk about the great resignation. We've got a number for last year. How about this one? 48 million people quit their jobs, a record high. 48 million. Because of that, the AFL-CIO did an hour-long webinar this week, and they kind of dissected the numbers and took a look at what happened, why workers were quitting their jobs. We're saying, well, yeah, because conditions with COVID-19, low pay. Well, there's a little bit more than that. And the bottom line for most of the respondents was it was the way they were treated at work. How about that? The way they were treated at work was what pushed them out the door. Time and time again, workers said unfair treatment, poor management, toxic environments. They were the worst parts of the job. So they said, I'm done. I'm done. And you know that's still going on. The AFL-CIO, and this is all posted on their website, aflcio.org. Liz Schuler was a big part of that conversation. She said, workers have never done more work and gotten less in return, less money, less respect, less predictability. And we know the only way to turn bad jobs into good jobs and to reset the balance of power is by taking collective action. The tides are turning. Momentum is building. And the doors to the labor movement are wide open. And to her point, we're seeing a whole lot of organizing and strikes. I'm going to talk about the painters here, members of Local 2012, IUPAT 2012. They want to strike for fair wages. This is out of Kansas City. 600 members there. That's District Council 3. Have voted to accept a new contract after going on strike for more than a week in their fight for fair wages to keep up with inflation. The construction workers in the Kansas City area recently rejected a proposal for a, how about this, 1% pay hike. A 1% pay hike. Are you kidding me? What's inflation right now? 8%? These were tough negotiations, and it's been a tough couple of weeks. That comment from Frank Carpenter. Frank's the District Council 3 business manager for the painters. He said, we appreciate the willingness of the contractors to come back to the table and their recognition of the value our members bring to their businesses. So hats off to IUPAT Local 2012 in Kansas City. One more here before we break. Members of the Parcass Union, which is an affiliate of the Writers Guild of America East, unanimously ratified their first contract this week. Parcass is a popular storytelling podcast production company owned by Spotify. Workers' new collective bargaining agreement provides significant wage increases, career development, and workplace safety provisions. along with binding commitments to enhance the company's diversity, inclusion, and equity. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our segment called Working Class Perspectives. This time, working class was right. Long time ago. We'll talk about it next.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with employment. You can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go to Cedar Falls, Iowa right now. Joining us on our live line is Dr. Christopher Martin, who's a professor of digital journalism at the University of Northern Iowa. And he's also a contributor to the blog Working Class Perspectives. And this is a good one. They're all good, but this one is even better than the others. It's about trade. We told you so on trade. The working class was right. We should also point out that Dr. Martin is paired up with the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor out of Georgetown University. Man's got many roles. Dr. Martin, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today?
Hey, great, great, great to talk to you.
We started this show. Well, I started hosting this show back in 1998. And boy, I recall in 99, a year after I started this show, there was the battle in Seattle. 50,000 protesters, all the media covering it. They were pretty much lambasted by the media, by the conservative talk show hosts saying, what's a bunch of radicals here? They don't know what they're talking about. Free trade. We have to accept free trade. It's going to be good for America. It's going to be good for jobs. You remember that time, don't you?
I do. Boy, it was big news, and not just in the conservative media, in the mainstream media, too. They were, you know, everyone, in officialdom was, you know, thought they were right, saying, yes, oh, this trade's going to be a great thing for us. So, but you're right, 50,000 people, a lot of them union people, came out and protested in Seattle because they were holding the World Trade Organization conference in Seattle. And what's interesting, since that time, they've never had one of those conferences back in the United States again. So,
yeah,
they've held them in places where it's safe to have conferences, like Singapore or Doha or something like that. The people were right. They were really concerned that this would decimate manufacturing jobs in the United States, and even the majority of Americans in a survey at the time, 52% supported the protesters, which doesn't happen always in the history of America that, you know, the people are supporting protesters. Like I said, the working class was right on this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I just want to throw out, remember Occupy Wall Street? I mean, that got a lot of media play. And, you know, when you take a look at what the protest was all about, I mean, Wall Street is responsible for everything that's going wrong when it comes to labor rights, when it comes to workers' rights and all that. So, yeah, they get a bad name. They're cast in a bad light. But the bottom line is the working class was right. Now, why don't you run down? Because right after that, we saw the normalizing of relations with China. And let's be fair here. This is not, like you pointed out, it's not just conservatives. Bill Clinton. Wasn't Bill Clinton a big free trader back in the 90s? Isn't that true?
That's right. And Bill Clinton was saying, you know, things like a rising tide will lift all boats and we're going to grow a bigger economic pie. And we know that that didn't happen. So, that you know, the idea was that if we start trading with China, a couple things will happen. You know, one is that, you know, China will become, you know, more of a liberal democracy. And we know that didn't happen. But also that it would create more jobs than it would ruin. And, you know, it did create some jobs, but it decimated manufacturing across the country. And if you look at charts of manufacturing, I mean, there's a point, you know, where China gets, you know, the most favored nation trade status. And, you know, and it becomes a member of the World Trade Organization in 2000. And right at that point, there's a cliff and manufacturing jobs just drop off in America. So, there, you know, it's very clear, you know, when you look at the data afterwards, that's exactly what was happened, at least what labor expected is exactly what happened.
Let's go before that date of 1999 when we had the battle in Seattle. And you point this out in your blog. 1979 is when manufacturing employment peaked in this country, 1979. What's the reasoning behind it? What happened? Was that when Reagan started taking over, the politics involved? What can you fill me in on some details there on what happened? Because this just didn't, it cascaded downward once they signed these trade deals. But there was a gradual burn off of workers from manufacturing during that time. Can you address that?
Yeah, there was all, you know, there were a number of trade agreements before the World Trade Organization. So, and we see those, you know, we see that becoming more popular in the 1980s and through the 1990s. And then there's that big cliff around 2000. It was already peeling off American jobs. And, if you're living, you know, in most places in America where there's manufacturing, you start to see that happening after that peak in 1979. So certainly during the Reagan era, but also the Clinton era. And fortunately, that was something that both parties agreed on, that, you know, they both thought they were brilliant in thinking, oh, we just need to open up trade and it's going to create more jobs. You know, and you can, you know, and as a president, you can go and have press conferences and visit places where there's new jobs being created. But they weren't visiting the places where jobs were being decimated, you know, through the 80s and into the 90s. So, you know, if you go around the United States, I mean, you see places like where that happened, like Youngstown, Ohio, like Edison, New Jersey, Van Nuys, California, St. Louis, Bloomington, Indiana, Decatur, Illinois. I mean, there's just devastation in communities all around the country. And there's a big cost to that. It's not just that those people, you know, as we know, those people in those places are going to get new jobs. If there are new jobs created, they're in other places. So if you live in a place like Youngstown, Ohio, and you lose major manufacturing, you know, your roots are there. There's real human costs involved. You can't sell your house for what it was worth because everyone's taking off. So it's just devastating to those communities, and it has real human costs.
And the manufacturing jobs, we all know they paid much better than the jobs that were created after those jobs went away. And you see, like in those areas, casinos pop up, Walmarts pop up, just a fraction of the wages that those workers are making when they were in the manufacturing sector. So let's fast forward to the pandemic here, because the pandemic, and I've said this on the show many times, almost every day, has changed everything. It kind of cast a light on the problems in America. And these people that were free traders are now scratching their heads saying, well, maybe we went a little too far. We have supply chain problems. And I'm just wondering, have we learned our lesson on this? You say the working class was right. Are they listening to the working class? That's my question.
Boy, I hope so. So, yeah, you remember when the pandemic hit 2 years ago, it was the first time a lot of Americans really realized what was going on. So there was, you know, people were shocked that the PPE, the personal protective equipment, wasn't available because it all came from China. So we didn't really have the capacity to make kind of basic stuff like that. And then we've, you know, more recently been hit with what people call supply chain problems, which is another way of saying this is how the global economy works these days. And this is a global economy that we set up. So, you know, when so many important things are manufactured elsewhere, you know, China and other places, if China shuts down, and right now, actually, China still has a major lockdown on a number of places, it slows the production of those things. And, you know, they come on big container ships and come to the United States. And so that's not a good thing. And again, people were warning, you know, more than 20 years ago, this will really upset our ability to be self-sustaining in a lot of manufacturing. But you know, manufacturing companies didn't, for the most part, didn't care. In fact, you know, what happened in all this is that, you know, as the EPA study showed, trade with low-wage countries like China has reduced wages nearly $2,000 per worker per year, you know, for over 100 million workers in the United States. And most of that was redistributed, you know, up high to the corporations themselves and workers at the top of the income distribution. So really, you know, this is what we live through. And sometimes people are scratching their heads now saying, like, well, how did this happen? It's like, well, you should have listened to people 20 years ago when they were protesting in Seattle, because this is exactly what they were predicting would happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. It really is amazing that they just don't listen to the people that are on the front line, because these are the people that know day in and day out. They know what's going on. They know how laws affect them in the workplace. But unfortunately, not enough people are listening. There's a few. And with that being said, I'm just wondering here, have you noticed, especially conservatives, hardcore conservatives, are now ganging up on China because of what happened here? Isn't that kind of an interesting political dynamic that's going on right now?
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, sadly ironic, because, you know, people wonder, well, how did China become, you know, so powerful? They're now, you know, the second largest economy, you know, and closing in on the United States. It's like, we made them that way, right? We just kind of offshored, you know, so much of our manufacturing capacity to China, to the point where now people talk about, well, we need to make more, you know, electronic components in the United States. And people say, well, you know, that's going to take years to build. It's like, and it will. You know, it took two decades to outfit China with these incredible manufacturing facilities. And the country, you know, helped to subsidize that. And, you know, it's going to take a long while if we are serious about, you know, being able to have those kinds of jobs and that manufacturing capacity in the United States to bring that back. So, you know, China's the bad guy. We made them the bad guy. You know, we made them our economic rival. You know, and China's not stupid. I mean, they knew what they were doing. And I think, you know, our corporate titans weren't stupid either. I mean, they're doing really well. The Standard & Poor's 500 profits last year were 13%, even as workers are still struggling to bring their wages up. And thank goodness there is a revive union movement. But we've got a long way to go. And through all of this, corporate profits have been fine.
Professor, as you know, there's a number of companies, Intel for one, that had a big presence in China. They still have a pretty big presence there, but they are relocating to the United States. In fact, they're planning to build a plant in the state of Ohio, and they have one in Arizona as well. Apple is kind of lax in that. We've been watching these companies, but as you pointed out, it's going to take a while. And right now, I'm just wondering how patient the American consumer is. You know, there's a chip shortage. People can't get their vehicles because of what happened here. And then you got the pandemic on top of it. So this is going to be an interesting one to play out here. Dr. Christopher Martin joining us on our live line. This is our segment we do each and every month called Working Class Perspectives. The op-ed is We Told You So on Trade, The Working Class Was Right. I noticed a number of publications have picked up on this one. I think New Geographic also did. You've got to be pretty happy about that. Any more feedback on your article, Professor?
Yeah, I've seen it picked up by a number of other blogs and distributed around. I think it, you know, it hit a nerve because it's, you know, just kind of revisiting our history and saying that, you know, we need to listen more to the working class. We need to talk to people and not just have, you know, high-level decision makers pulling the strings of the economy. There's real people involved here, and they know what's going on, you know, at the grassroots level.
Couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us. Dr. Christopher Martin, Professor of Digital Journalism at the University of Northern Iowa. He's also author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. Yeah, there's a lot of things that have happened to the working class, and the media is one of them. Dr. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. We'll keep in touch, okay?
Thanks. My pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Benjamin Davis is the International Affairs Director for the United Steelworkers, and he's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
American workers are the best in the world. But we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so keep them coming. Also want to point out, this next segment is brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to Washington, D.C. right now. Joining us in our live line is Mr. Benjamin Davis. And Ben is the Director of International Affairs for the United Steelworkers, proud sponsor of America's Workforce. He's been with the steelworkers for 12 years. He's been all over labor. Worked with the service employees in International Union, the hotel employees, as long with the American Federation of Government Employees. He also has a law degree from the Washington College of Law at the American University. Ben Davis, welcome to America's Workforce. How are we doing today, brother?
Real good. Real good. Glad to be on.
International Affairs Director. Let's talk about that. That sounds like a lot of work. It really does. Can you tell me your role with the steelworkers?
I don't work harder than anybody else in the union, but you know my job is to coordinate with other labor unions around the world on the issues that are important to our members. That could be a contract campaign or a strike. It could also be on a policy issue, like, for example, trade, where we've been doing a lot of work with unions in other countries, especially recently.
Yeah, we just got off the phone with a professor out of Iowa, and we were talking about the trade deals in the last 20 years. Do you remember the battle in Seattle?
I do, and we've been fighting this fight for a while to get people to understand that, you know, trade isn't just about, you know, pushing a commodity back and forth across lines. You got to look at where it's made and how mm-hmm. and who makes it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what we were talking about is the fact that the working class was right. You saw the protests that happened then, and they were saying, you know what, this is not a good way to go. But nobody listened. They normalized relations with China, and we've lost at least 4 million jobs in a 20-year period. It's actually not 20 years. The calculation is 17 years, so it's probably more than 4 million jobs. That's the part I don't understand. How come these people, is it just because the corporations are driving this or what? What's your thoughts on that?
You know, there's a lot of money washing around the global economy, and there's a lot of money washing around Congress. And, you know, we have some great people, Sherrod Brown, Nancy Pelosi, you know, who get it and have gotten it for a long time. But money talks.
Yeah.
And I think folks money know talks. The other half of that expression, too.
I'm glad you restrained yourself. That's good. So let's talk about NAFTA 2.0. And now it's called the USMCA. And this is something that Donald Trump negotiated. Didn't have all the labor protections. Now, were you part of those negotiations? Talk to me about that part, Ben.
The steelworkers were very involved, you know, with a number of folks in Congress who, you know, had never agreed. There were a lot of Democrats that, you know, never agreed with the idea that, you know, NAFTA should just be open up our borders and bring in goods from the maquiladoras in Mexico that are, you know, produced by people making, you know, a dollar an hour, right? When Trump decided to renegotiate it, you know, we had an opening and we said, well, you know, we're happy to renegotiate it because we never liked it in the first place. But, you know, renegotiating just doesn't mean, you know, make a new corporate deal. It means that the labor rights protections really have to be in, and they really have to be serious for the first time, which was not in Trump's proposal. There was nothing about labor in Trump's proposal. Right. So, in fact, the first time when they sent that proposal up, you know, the labor and the Democrats said, nope, it's not going to fly because there's no worker rights protections. Administration said, OK, well, give us some worker rights protections. And you know, we went back and we got them.
So they reached out to you and said, write it up and we'll put it in. Was it that easy?
No. I mean, this is all way above my level, you know. But there was a political negotiation, and the outcome of it was that, you know, the labor rights protections got put in.
Okay, so it took a little time to work in the labor provisions. I'm wondering, in your opinion, Ben, are they strong enough? I mean, we've seen some results of like the workers wanting an independent union over there, but what's your thoughts on that?
I'll put it this way. You know, labor is never satisfied, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And in any negotiation, you know, you don't get everything that you ask for. But we think that the rapid response mechanism, you know, which is what it's called, is the strongest thing that we've got in any trade agreement to protect the rights of workers. And of course, now we have to actually apply it on the ground, which is starting to happen. And we're actually seeing, you know, in the first cases that this is a mechanism that works.
So this vote that was done, can we reflect on that? I believe it was a GM plant down there, and the workers didn't like the union that Mexico had. And Mexico has unions, but they're not like the unions in the United States. And I know they were monitoring that election. That's all the result of what happened with the USMCA? What panned out in that election then?
No, it's the result of a lot of struggle and sacrifice by the workers, you know, there on the ground who ever since GM came in and set up that plant, because there are a lot of auto plants in Mexico now, you know, they make about, I'm trying to remember the exact amount, but they make about starting wages around $250 an hour. I think the top was around close to $5 an hour, right? But not very many people made the top. So, you know, you can compare that to what the wages are for unionized or even non-unionized workers in the U.S. You see, there's a huge gap, 10 to 1 roughly. And that gap has been there, you know, since the beginning of NAFTA. And we've been arguing the whole time that, you know, you can't have a fair economic system where you've got, you know, two partners in it, and in one country, the workers make 10 times as much as the other. So there's two ways you can close that wage gap. You can either bring the American wages down, which is what's been happening, or, radical idea, you can raise the Mexican wages up. And, you know, it's not a new argument. We've been making this argument since the 80s. But the idea behind rapid response is that we now have some tools to actually make that happen. Is it happening? Too early to tell. We don't have the data. You know, we've only had a few cases. So, you know, you can't say it's a success at this point, but that is the concept behind it.
So that $2.50 an hour, is that the current wage rate in Mexico? Is that what in an automobile factory? Is that what it is?
That's the starting wage in this plant, and you know that's not out of line with other major manufacturing. Yeah.
So under the USMCA, just wondering the fact that the unions have a little more power down there. I guess it's going to matter of time before those wages start going. We want those wages to go up. We don't want the wages in America to go down anymore. But do you see that happening?
The first problem is what you just pointed to, the wage gap. The second problem is the unions, because in Mexico, historically, most of the unions have been controlled by the employers. And so they're not unions that are fighting to raise the wages. They're unions that are basically, you know, collaborating with the company. And what rapid response does is it creates a path for workers who disagree with that to organize a real union, an independent democratic union, and fight for higher wages. So first they got to organize. And there are some, right? It's not 100%. There's some strong unions like the mine workers that you know, have been there for a long time. But the majority, especially in the newer manufacturing, is these, we call them protection unions. Protection because they're there to protect the boss, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
First job is get rid of the protection union. Second job is fight to raise the wages.
Protect the boss, but don't protect the workers. Is that what I'm hearing in this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, there's been, you know, there's examples like that in American history, too. But it wasn't as widespread as it is in Mexico.
I'm wondering here, too. Say the rapid response thing, especially those workers that want to speak out. And here's what scares me. It's Mexico. We know Mexico is a dangerous country. In all different ways. I'm just wondering, those workers who do speak out, especially with the protections now that they have in the USMCA and more labor rights, not enough in my opinion, probably your opinion as well, but I'm wondering what could happen to these people? Can they be jailed? Can they be shot? What's your take on that?
Look, that is a concern. You know, almost any place in the world where we try to support workers. You know, I mean, Mexico, Indonesia, Philippines, China. You know, but I will say that, and in the cases you mentioned, the GM case, and in that case, you know, the leader of the independent union did receive threats. Fortunately, nothing happened. You know, she had good support from her coworkers, and there weren't any consequences of that. But yeah, it's a concern. It's something that workers in Mexico, and frankly, you know, you read American labor history, workers in the U.S. have had to deal with for many decades, and you know, it's just something that I don't say we like it, but you know, it's part of the expectation, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fact, no doubt. Benjamin Davis joining us on our live line. He is the International Affairs Director for the United Steelworkers, USW.org. For more information, we'll talk more right after this.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's L-I-U-N-A.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Ben Davis. Ben's the Director of International Affairs for the United Steelworkers, the largest industrial union in North America. 850,000 workers in various industries, metals, rubber, chemicals, paper, oil, atomic energy, forestry, you name it. They're all over the place, even nursing, too. Well, primarily healthcare workers. I know they have a big presence in various states. Ben, you wanted to say more about the situation in Mexico. We're talking about workers' rights in Mexico, and we've seen an erosion of wages ever since they signed off. Well, Clinton was in office 1993. NAFTA happened, and then fast forward to the Trump administration. They threw it out, redid it. We have the USMCA, a little bit better situation. You wanted to talk more about the GM factory there. What's the story?
Yeah, and I mean, because people might have questions about, you know, so rapid response, you know, great idea means that, you know, there is a path for workers who have a company dominated union to change that, right? They can, they can get rid of that union. They can have a new election. They can form an independent union. They can have a fair election. And so we've had two cases so far. There's a third one that's just been filed, on Panasonic, but the first two, one was filed on a company called Tridnex and the other, on, General Motors. And, you know, what happened in both of those cases, I think that's really interesting, is from the time that the case was filed, there were delays, there were violations, you know, committed by the companies, but nobody was fired. People were fired before, but people weren't fired once the U.S. government came in and said, you know, we're putting Mexico on notice. There's an investigation. It could end up even going to a dispute panel under USMCA. The companies backed off, and they didn't fire the union leaders. Now, anyone who's been in an organizing campaign in the U.S. knows that the very first thing the employer will do is fire the union leaders.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there'll be an unfair labor practice charge, and maybe even someday they'll have to get reinstated. But, you know, the damage is done when a group of workers is trying to organize. You know, they cut off the head of the campaign, and that does a lot of damage. So, so it's really significant that we got a mechanism in Mexico that actually is strong enough. Now, what's the mechanism? It means that these companies are subject to specific tariffs of on their goods. And in the case of GM, the tariff that they were looking at is 25%. And from the time that the U.S. Trade Representative, Katherine Tai, filed the case, the company had to pay into an escrow $10 million a day for every day. Now, they didn't have to turn that money over, but, you know, if it went to a dispute panel and they lost, they were going to have to pay that money. It took about 100 days for the case to be resolved. And during that time, I don't have the exact amount, but, you know, roughly they paid in $1 billion. And they were on the hook for that amount of money. Now, the difference, if you think about the difference between the U.S. law and this rapid response mechanism, imagine if, you know, workers at a factory in Ohio wanted to organize, and the National Labor Relations Board would come in and say, okay, you know, we'll work through this case, but the company is going to be on the hook $10 million a day for every day for any violations they might commit.
Boy, that would make a difference, wouldn't it?
You kind of think, right? So, I mean, there's this funny way in which, in specific circumstances, the tools that we have in Mexico in some ways are stronger than the tools we have in the U.S. right now. I'm not making a direct comparison, but, you know, it does make you think.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's an effective mechanism. It's certainly produced really good results in the first two cases, overwhelming victories for the independent unions. Again, the real work was done by those workers. You know, the rapid response doesn't get people to vote for a union if they don't want to vote for it. But if they do want to vote for it, it creates a space where they can do that without having to worry about being fired or intimidated. And, you know, that's really important, and anyone who's been in the organizing campaign here, you know, would understand immediately how important that is.
Ben, just to be clear, was any of that money paid, or they were just
have to pay it because the case was resolved and they had the election, and, you know, there's still some issues, you know. I mean, we always have concerns about how the process worked, but you know, the fundamental part. Well, and of course, now all they won after the folks at GM had to, first they had to have a vote to get rid of their contract, and then they had to have another vote where the four unions competed, and the first one had to be rerun. So they actually had to vote three times just to get the right to negotiate a contract. And now they're in those negotiations, and those are tough negotiations because, you know, they've never done this before, and GM is a big, big company. So the story's not over, but, you know, I think the part where rapid response would have an effect, which is just getting the workers to the starting line with a democratic union. You know, we've seen good results so far.
Ben, I know that rapid response program on behalf of the steelworkers has been tremendous. And what you told us today is just another example of how powerful that tool is. And then you throw in the $10 million a day. Yeah, that gets the company's attention. In a hurry, I might add.
It wouldn't be that high, you know, in every case, but, you know, it was just that one really caught my eye, and, you know, maybe some other people's eyes as well.
Yeah, they got to bring that to America. That will definitely wake up some people on this end. Oh my gosh, especially negotiating a deal. Ben, great job. Thank you so much for joining us. Ben Davis, International Affairs Director for the United Steelworkers. Let's do this again. I appreciate your input on the show. We certainly appreciate what the steelworkers do. So you keep up the fight, and please stay in touch. How's that sound?
Really, really happy to be here, and thanks for the great job that you guys do in supporting American workers.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the Transportation Trades Department, and we talk to an iron worker in Iowa who's running for office. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.